Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. Pianist Martina Filiak will be the soloist next week when the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra opens its 2013-14 masterwork season. For the occasion, music director-conductor Philip Mann has programmed the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto No. 1 in B-flat minor, the opening chords of which are probably the best known in the concerto repertoire. Martina is from Croatia, and her parents, both concert pianists, were her first teachers. The world knows what happened when the former Yugoslavia broke up, the years of fighting for independence in those Balkan states, so my first concern was how old was she and the effect these events had on her.
Thank you for asking this. I think and I believe that by the time, let's say, the war for the national independence started, I was about 11 or 12 years old. So I think I was definitely old enough to realize what was going on. Definitely, it was a very, very painful moment for everybody who was involved. I think I can now say that it was surely very painful and very difficult for both, for all the sides involved. I mean, certainly, partly, I'm very sorry that I had to go through it. In another sense, I have really learned a lot, and I have also, I think, learned a lot about coping and about just trying to be positive and get on with your life. Something that has helped me a lot in the, you know, perhaps less dramatic situations that I experienced later on, but the skill was still needed. It doesn't mean I don't get stressed, but I think I realized that as much as I would like it, I'm not able to change the world. But having said that, I still very much believe that each of us is able to change the world if we are just, you know, trying to be the better person every day. We can gradually influence the other ones around
right.
us.
This must have come at a time when you were well into your training in the piano with your parents, I'm assuming. As you say, both parents were pianists, and were they professional performers as well?
Unfortunately, by that point, my father had passed away, so I was living alone with my mother at that point. But yes, they were both professional pianists, and at that same time, I was, of course, going to school, and I was going to middle school, and I was having occasional lessons with my mother as well, so it was all kind of combined. And once, I think we had a break from school for a couple of months, you know, because everything was in a kind of state of collapse, and my mother continued training me and schooling me at home during that time. The first time I went away from home was at the age of either 15 or 16. That was my first destination, was, of course, to study piano at the Vienna Conservatory.
Okay.
And afterwards, I have lived in various places and studied in various places, and for the past few years, I settled in Berlin in Germany.
So that's your main home now?
I use that as my hub right now.
Yeah.
So to say.
Do you still have a coach that you work with when you go back to your hub?
No, I don't. But I really enjoy working in music and various other arts. I feel I can learn a lot about music. And I think a great part and a very humbling part of being a musician is the fact that you're learning your whole life. You're never really quite finished. Again, this thing about becoming a better person and becoming a better musician, it's very humbling, and I think this is very good. My ways to do it nowadays are either working with orchestras and working with conductors or performing chamber music with various instruments. I learn really a great deal from conductors and from my colleagues or just from other musicians, just performing with them and just hearing them. There's always a great in a different point of view. So, you know, a different point of view is not necessarily a bad thing. There is a great power and great knowledge coming from it.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy that a lot.
Now, do you have any particular, the conductor or soloist, a cellist, a pianist, that influenced you in terms of approach to interpretation and music and something that they would bring that would lighten or enlighten something that you were working with?
You know, something happens really all the time. Something happens all the time if you're open. A very wonderful experience that, of course, I'd like to point out was recently when I recorded some chamber music works by Robert Schumann with a really wonderful cellist called Jan Vogler. The recording was recently published at Sony Classical, and it was really a great experience. He really helped me see the bigger picture of music and help me be very confident and very easygoing during the recording. But it really, you know, depends on the person. It really depends on the situation. And sometimes it also depends a great deal on me. Sometimes what I need in order to feel good is somebody telling me that I'm on the right track. And sometimes I need exactly an opposite view and an opposite opinion to make me go further. So it sort of keeps changing.
Your love of nature, your sympathy with composers who seem to develop a wonderful way of interpreting the world in which we all live, was this also part of your living through your difficult growing years in Croatia?
Not really. I mean, the difficult part started when I was about 11 or 12. Before that, I think I was a very, very happy child. I had a very happy childhood. We got to spend, especially I think comparing to children, you know, that are living today, we, at a certain point, we didn't have a TV or, you know, the TV program was not interesting at all, so we hardly ever really watched it, especially in the former Yugoslavia, but also afterwards. And we didn't have video games. We didn't have really fancy, very, very fancy toys. So as children, we used to spend a lot of time outdoors. We used to go to a lot of hiking. We were running around. We were playing. We were very, very happy children. And, you know, as a concert pianist and musician, I really miss that part a lot because I'm so often shut in a hotel room or in a plane or in a practice room, and I don't get to experience nature as much as I would like to. So whenever I have a holiday or whenever I have some free time, I actually try to go outdoors, and I try to hike. I try to see green, green mountains or green hills or anything green. That somehow it really helps me revive. And I'm definitely not the only case, because as you said yourself, there has been so many composers that were directly inspired by nature. So there is an immediate connection between music and nature that has been, and it's been like this for centuries.
Yes.
Always, probably.
Now, it mentions that you have a wide variety and repertoire and 30 concertos, and of those many concertos that you've played and been introduced to, where would you put the Tchaikovsky that you're going to play here?
The Tchaikovsky, well, the Tchaikovsky would certainly be a concerto that I did not learn to appreciate right from the start. I think when I first played it, when I was 15 or 16, I had to play it, and I thought, oh, it's so often played, and everybody knows it. And, you know, then afterwards, of course, I realized that this exactly is the challenge of giving your best efforts to make this music sound fresh. It's dangerous to say original, but yes, at least fresh and renewed. And there's a great challenge in making an effort to make an independent view for yourself about that music, regardless of all the performances and of all the recordings that have already been made. Since I did these efforts and since I took the challenge of sort of discovering the piece for myself, I grew more and more fond of it. And right now I think it has more substance. It has more substance than I ever thought.
So did any particular movement or phrasing or maybe somebody else's playing that released an idea that you hadn't realized you were containing within yourself?
Well, there's certainly a great inspiration in a recording conducted by Herbert von Karajan, and he treats the first movement in a very constructive way. It sounds almost like the first movement of a Beethoven symphony, and I thought it was simply marvelous. And I greatly admire a live recording by Van Cliburn, whose performance of third movement is just stunning, just really wonderful. He brings out exactly what needs to be brought out, and it's really fantastic.
I wonder when that was recorded in his career.
I would guess in the 1960s.
So he was still exploring the composition himself, probably.
Very, very possible. Well, I think it was after he had won the Tchaikovsky competition, so he was really on the top of his game at that point, and it sounded very much like it.
But he was such an interesting, introspective person that I can imagine him after that stunning victory that sort of shocked the world into realizing who he was and where he was from, would have made him go back to it just to renew himself, as it were, with the piece that had been so much part of his life up till that point.
Well, I mean, what can I say? He was an artist. He was just an artist. And the world, I think it's about time that the world has to start judging people because of their artistry and not, you know, based on some kind of presumptions of who they are or mm-hmm. where they are coming from. This is maybe the bottom line. And he proved a very, very big point by winning that competition at that time.
Of course, the fact that he's died this year has made requests for that particular piece much more than it would be normally anyway.
That could be the chance. That could be the point, yes.
So you're coming here to play it, and you've already played it last year, and requests are still coming in, I'm sure. Now that you have learned to be so involved with the music much more than when you first met it yourself, with the number of requests coming in, do you sit back and think, now I've got to just see where I am with this piece?
Well, absolutely. What you're saying right now is kind of also on the trace of what I just said. But it is also always very much a matter of balance. I think the true musician, for my personal taste, should still always try to put himself on the second place, and on the first place should be, you know, the composer's desires and the composer's thoughts. On the first place should absolutely be to try to really understand who the composer and what his music was all about, and your own little heart's desires always have to come on the second place. But that's just my opinion.
Tchaikovsky's life has been written about so often. And when, as I'm sure you had studied him and his compositions in all aspects of what he wrote and where he wrote it, when you first started to explore it more personally, does that put it into the perspective of his life? Did it lend you an idea or like a key into helped you explore it more in depth?
Well, I mean, he was a very young composer when he was writing this particular first piano concerto, and I have mentioned the thing before, which is that, for example, in Karajan's performance, the first movement is sounding very much like a Beethoven symphony. And I do think, although, of course, the concerto is very romantic, it's also following the Russian national style. There is a lot of folkloric elements, especially in the third movement. But I do still think that we all have this collective knowledge of the classical composers of Mozart and Beethoven and of the form of the classical sonata that has so often marked the first movement of a great piano concerto. And I'm absolutely certain that throughout his knowledge of composition and throughout his consciousness, the young composer Tchaikovsky was certainly writing the first movement of his first concerto on the traits of Beethoven's music. This is for sure. And on the other hand, as much as we know about the composer and as much as we can read about his life, there is always this factor of a kind of collective knowledge and a certain point in which a person understands it that is very, very difficult to judge today. I personally very strongly believe in it, and I also very strongly believe in not only knowing the life of the composer is necessary, but knowing a wide range of music that has marked the time and the time before, and on whose legacy they were, you know, writing and growing up and learning. Because sometimes the idols or the role models are maybe a little bit more important than a momentary psychological state of that person, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who he was looking up to is maybe a little more important than whether he was sad or happy at that moment, because ultimately that was the big picture for him.
Pianist Martina Filiak will be the soloist with the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra next weekend, playing the much-loved Concerto No. 1 in B-flat minor by Tchaikovsky on the opening pair of Masterworks concerts in the 2013-14 season. Saturday, September the 21st, and Sunday the 22nd in Robinson Center Music Hall. On the Sunday matinee, students K through 12 will be admitted free with an adult through the generosity of Entergy. For tickets, call 501-666-1761 or visit online arkansassymphony.org.
Here's a look at what's happening in the arts in Arkansas. On stage at the Arkansas Rep, Pal Joey, with shows today at 2 and 7, and performances Wednesday through Sunday through September 29th. This afternoon at 3, UALR's Arts Preseason opens with mezzo-soprano Sasha Cook performing at UALR's Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall. Tomorrow, Ms. Cook will present a masterclass at 12:15 at the university, free and open to the public. The River City Men's Chorus performs this afternoon at 3 at Trinity United Methodist Church, with repeat performances tomorrow at 7 p.m. and Wednesday at 7. This evening at 5, the Friends of Contemporary Craft present a conversation with studio artist Jennifer Trask at the Arkansas Arts Center. Thursday, Bernice Gardens presents the 5th Annual Sculpture Party and Fall Fest at 1401 South Main in downtown Little Rock, 5:30 to 7 p.m. Friday and Saturday at Weekend Theater, 100 Saints You Should Know, showtimes at 7:30 each night. And next Sunday at Arkansas State University's Fowler Center, Rhonda Vincent and The Rage perform. On display around Little Rock, just opened at Historic Arkansas Museum, Reflections from the Monday Studio Artists, works by 4 painters from Hot Springs Village. At the Arkansas Arts Center, Interwoven Craft and Interwoven Paper. At the Old State House Museum, Lights, Camera, Arkansas. At the Clinton Presidential Center, and Freedom for All, the March on Washington. And at the Arkansas Studies Institute, Get a Simple Landscape, drawings by Jerry Phillips, and the Mid-Southern Watercolorist 43rd Annual Juried Exhibition. And that's a look at the arts calendar for this week. For more on what's going on in Arkansas, visit our online calendar at ualrpublicradio.org.
The Arkansas Arts Center Children's Theater always presents a season with the familiar and the not so much, where for some, such as I, there are unknown quantities. This 2013-14 season does it for me, with the title of the first show, Pinkalicious. And I asked my guest, Bradley Anderson, the Children's Theater Director, if this was a Keith Smith invention, and was quickly brought up to date.
No, Pinkalicious is a book. It may be a series of books that are relatively new, relatively contemporary. They're wildly popular. Anecdotally, we've gotten just all kinds of very young girls who are just completely in love with Pinkalicious, who is a little girl who loves pink so much. Everything in her life is pink, and she eats so many pink cupcakes that she turns pink. And through the course of the book, it's a early reader book, she learns how to find some moderation and turn herself back to the proper color.
Because otherwise you'd have to find a pink companion group, and she would have to go through this pink stage realizing that she didn't really belong anywhere, mm-hmm. and having to adjust to a world that was, for little girls and boys and everybody else, trying to find their way in the world anyway, to be that different would be very difficult.
Very difficult. There is a companion story about her little brother who is faced almost with the same kind of dilemma in a very different way. But he too learns to find moderation. And that, in there lies the story.
And are you directing that one?
No, that is being directed by Scott Ferguson, who was formerly a student of ours many years ago, kind of came up through the program, and then went to school at Northwestern and created a theater company in Chicago.
So he stayed in theater as a result of what he did?
He very much stayed in theater. He's the artistic director of this company, and wrote Schoolhouse Rock Live, which is a play that has been produced all over the country multiple times. Uh-huh. In fact, we've done it twice here, and he came back to direct it both times.
Now, number two is The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Have you done that one before?
No, we haven't. We did a tour of The Sorcerer's Apprentice in 1980.
Oh my goodness! Yes.
Something, but it was an entirely different show. Keith has written this and taken for him a somewhat familiar approach in that there is a contemporary element where a contemporary young woman desiring to be an apprentice goes back in time.
So has Keith sort of touched on some of those earlier connections to the classical story, or is it just something that he's picked to, as you say, be contemporary, to appeal to the children of the 21st century?
He sort of amalgamated it all. Mm-hmm. So there is the story remains intact. It is seen through the eyes of someone who is much more contemporary. Yeah. So there is a connection to the modern world.
Usually touch on how the season is approached and all the particular titles and plays that you look at and whether to resurrect some that you haven't done for a long time, which, again, obviously part of your heritage. And
right.
You've been there long enough to remember some of the things that worked and some of the things that you would like the chance to do something slightly different.
Exactly. And there are those stories that simply should be told every 10 years or so, because the audience has changed up entirely. We think of it kind of as a permanent rotating decade-by-decade rep mm-hmm. of show titles. Anyway, they're brought back as a whole, or we take a new approach and just reattack the title again, which is kind of a nice way to do it.
Yeah. Some of the challenging ones that you've done in the past, I haven't seen repeated yet. The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yes.
And the one that you weren't allowed to do it again was the Lord of the Flies.
Right.
Now, The Sorcerer's Apprentice is a classic for all ages. The Little Engine That Could, you've done before, I think.
No.
Haven't you?
No, we haven't. No one, to my knowledge, has done The Little Engine That Thought It Could, which is the classic book.
Ah.
The actual story, The Engine That Thought That It Could, was written, and it really circulated in primarily the churches at the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm. Which century?
yeah, got me. It, in order to teach that lesson about if you try hard enough, you will succeed. Finally put down on paper somewhere around 1910, we think.
Yeah.
Now that is in the public domain. And so that is the story that we took. And it's basically the same story. It's, in fact, it's exactly the same story.
Mm-hmm. It's just, but you've got a different slant on it. And
we're doing it as a holiday story that the engine, the little engine, saves Christmas by being able to haul the books and toys up the too tall mountain when the regular large engine is too ill to do it.
You can always add all kinds of personalities to a character.
Exactly.
Like that.
It's going to be a lot of fun. It's a musical. It'll be great fun.
And is it Laura Lee who's going to be doing your music for you? Does she still do that?
Absolutely.
Amazing. Then the next one, I thought to myself, that has to be a Keith Smith. Click, clack, moo cows that type. And I'm trying to think, because you've done several years now, a sort of combination of two short fairy stories, like The Three Little Bears and the Billy Goat's Gruff or whatever. You've combined a couple of titles in one performance without actually tying them together. This I was trying to figure out. Now, which fairy stories would these be? And I couldn't place them. So please tell us the background of this.
Click, clack, moo, cows that type actually is an existing story.
Mm-hmm.
Of a book written that explores, I think it's Farmer Brown, and his cows all collectively get together and let him know that they are dissatisfied with their treatment. And they begin typing out little notes for the farmer to let them know that they have some changes they want to make. And through the help of some other of the barnyard animals, they are able to effectively straighten out whatever their issues are.
Sort of an incipient, was it, animal farm?
Kind of a little animal farm in a way, yes.
Now, the Clack old typewriter, how many children will recognize that?
Now, you know, that we don't know. It's probably very few.
You're giving it something of a fresh approach, as you might say.
Oh, yes. That play exists. We secured it through one of the...
It's not out of copyright yet.
No, it's a very contemporary story.
The next two, to bring your titles up to six, which seems to be the best way of dividing a season, The Boy Who Cried Wolf. Is that an Aesop fable?
It is. The approach we're taking on that is right up your alley, as it were. It's a radio drama of the classic story, The Boy Who Cried Wolf. And by doing so, when real trouble came, he was unable to convince anyone that he was being real. It's all done sort of as a visual radio play. So it's really fun. We did a tour of it a few years ago that was quite popular. And so we decided it would be a good idea to expand that onto the main stage.
And do you do that the way that they used to do radio plays, where you'd all stand by microphones and maybe have a wolf's head on one of them or something
right,
like that?
Right. It's sort of a concoction of strange people doing odd things in order to make the sounds and so on.
Is there a script for this particular version, or are you writing that yourselves?
We're writing it. One iteration of it has been written, and we'll expand it now.
Do most of your productions each year call upon a similar number of actors, children on the stage, or do some require many more than you would normally see in one of your productions?
It varies wildly. Mm-hmm. There are those shows that, by virtue of the difficulty of their music, simply have to be all adults or all professional people, or tours have to be all professional people. The main stage, it just really depends on the title and what the needs are.
And how many people audition for it.
And how many people audition, right.
Do you see the numbers changing at all from when you first started with children's theater? You get more or less?
Not really. I think it's much more difficult for students to participate now.
Because of what demands are made at that time elsewhere.
At school, yeah. Yes. There was a day when a student could virtually do all six shows in the season, as long as they kept their grades up.
Yeah.
Now, anymore, I think it's much more in... They can do one in the first half of the year and one in the second half of the year if their school is...
Yes, so if you have one of them who just shines and you think, oh, gosh, I must have that particular
right,
actor.
We'd love to use them.
And turns out he or she can't do that. It must be kind of frustrating.
It happens, yeah.
Yes, I'm sure.
It's a little sad for everybody.
Yes. And then Sleeping Beauty.
Sleeping Beauty will be huge.
Are you going right back to the Perrault, back to France, the original story, or it'll be a little bit of Disney and a little bit of music and Tchaikovsky and things like that?
We think so. That particular script has not been written yet. That'll happen in the next month or so, I think. And we have done Sleeping Beauty before, but it's a story that kind of exists in everybody's heart somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So we just have to recollect what all that is and then refashion a new play, I think.
And you said it's huge. You mean you've got a big cast?
It's a big cast. It's big ideas. It's big scenery. It's big everything.
Wind up the season with a flourish.
With a big flourish, yeah.
Yes.
A real beautiful story.
Yes. Evil gets its comeuppance.
A real fairy tale.
Yes. That was Bradley Anderson, director of the Arkansas Arts Center Children's Theater, which opens its 2013-14 season September the 20th with Pinkalicious. Performances each weekend, Fridays at 7, Saturdays at 3, and Sundays at 2 p.m. through October the 6th. For tickets, call 501-372-4000. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.